On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bad to worse headlines around the world this week. 12 Israelis dead in a single day yesterday. 100 Hezbollah rockets launched in less than an hour. 900 dead in Lebanon under Israeli attack. 3,000 wounded. 1 million displaced. At home, heat wave and global warming nightmares. Mel Gibson on an anti-Semitic tear. Top American generals conceding Iraq may be sliding into civil war. No minimum wage break for the poor. Even the rich couldn't catch a break on passing their billions untaxed to the kids. Tony Blair says a ceasefire must come in the Middle East, but it's hard to see. Up next on Point, a week in the news from Beirut to boiling temperatures. We need a break. We have a terrific panel with us this week. Joining me from Washington is Carol Giacomo, diplomatic correspondent for Reuters News Service. Carol, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
From Columbia, South Carolina, Kathleen Parker, syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. In today's column, the Christians are coming, the Christians are coming. She writes about fear that American evangelicals are driving the U.S. into big trouble with Israel. Not so, she says. Kathleen Parker, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Carol Giacomo, first to you, Mideast, any chance of a ceasefire here, or is this all just smoke until the fighting is over? What does that mean?
Well, they're certainly working at it, the UN, and talking about it, but whether or not they can actually get a ceasefire or whether the United States is still trying to delay an actual resolution until Israel makes more progress on the ground is really anybody's guess.
Kathleen Parker, do you want to see a ceasefire in the Middle East?
Well, of course. I mean, any sane person wants to see a ceasefire. I mean, we don't want to keep watching this ongoing battle and in these deaths after all. But
a lot of voices saying don't stop Israel until you've really got this cleaned up. If you stop short of that, it's a failure.
Well, a sustainable ceasefire makes a lot of sense since we seem to go through this every few years. And Israel absolutely has a right to defend itself. They've just decided that they're going to finish this once and for all, apparently. When that ceasefire occurs and under what conditions remains to be seen, I couldn't possibly guess. But of course, we'd like to see it come to an end as quickly as possible. But I think sustainable is the operative word.
Jack Beatty, if sustainable is the operative word, how long till we get, a low death toll?
That's the issue. I mean, this is a humanitarian disaster for Israel, which suffered a loss of life yesterday, tantamount given its population, to September 11th here, and of course for the civilians of Lebanon. Human Rights Watch published a very tough report yesterday about Israel's bombings, and they conclude that some of these attacks constitute war crimes. They looked at 20 different strikes, 153 dead civilians, 63 of them children, and they found that in these, they could find no case here where that there was any immediate evidence that Hezbollah had been firing rockets from around where the places these attacks were made. And they looked closely at Kana. They were there the day after the attack. They could see no evidence of destroyed rockets there. They could see no evidence of fighters. They pointed out that there were the four roads in and out of the town were blocked, and therefore material couldn't be easily taken over them. And the people in Kana told them that the guerrillas had been firing from the hills, not from the town. And since then, of course, the Israelis have admitted that they had no information on rockets launched from the site of the building or the presence of Hezbollah at the time.
At the time, though they said that there had been plenty fired from there in previous days, 100 or so, I think I read them saying.
That's right. But they're also now saying from the surrounding area. And, you know, again, whether these are war crimes or not, one doesn't know. But the hypothesis, the picture they fit, is one really given some credence by the statement of the Israeli justice minister, who said all those now in South Lebanon are terrorists who are related in some way to Hezbollah. Well, that's women and children and old people. Are they terrorists?
Well, if they're still there, almost, I mean, a million on the road, maybe they're not there anymore, Jack.
Well, that they are there, and that's the trouble. And it all—it really looks as if the effort here is ethnic cleansing, really to clear out all people, not guerrillas, from south of the Litani River, so that effectively, that whole population, well, what's left of it, will surge to the north.
Let's hear.
Hezbollah, though,
can I just get in on this?
Yes,
I think calling it ethnic cleansing is really over the top. I live in Washington. If people were lobbing rockets from Virginia to Washington, people in Washington would be pretty angry about it. And Israel had put up with cross-border attacks for a long time, and the UN has long had a resolution that required Hezbollah to be disarmed, and that never happened.
But Carol, let me ask you, even critics are saying, why don't they go in on the ground instead of from the air and really do this right if they want to lock down this area? Charles Krauthammer saying they missed an opportunity here to really go in strong, in force, on the ground, rather than bombing, which may end up with a higher civilian death toll in that zone. What do you think, Carol?
Well, I think you're really putting your finger on the main point, and that is there's an asymmetric war here. You have a group of it's a non-state military group, which apparently is extremely well organized and very well funded by Iran and equipped by Iran and backed by Syria as well. And it's a real problem for Israel. How do you defend against it? And they're going to have to come up with more creative ways, it seems, to thwart this threat.
Kathleen Parker, here's a headline from The Economist, no liberal magazine. It says, the longer the war goes on, the stronger the Islamists and those who reject peace with Israel are becoming across the region. Isn't that the terrible calculus behind whether or not you agree with Human Rights Watch that these may be war crimes? Isn't that the strategic calculus here?
Well, of course, and I haven't read the Human Rights Watch report yet, unfortunately, and this is some news to me that Israel is now reporting they did not have rockets directly from that area.
Just at that time, they said.
Well, exactly, and they had fielded 150 or so rockets mm-hmm. from that area. And, Hezbollah, let's remember that Hezbollah began this by kidnapping the soldiers and by continuously being aggressive toward Israel. But Israel is really in a no-win situation here. I mean, they can either sit back and continue to take this fire, or they can go in and respond to Hezbollah and do exactly what, as you say, what Hezbollah wants them to do, which is attack in such a way that civilian deaths are almost always guaranteed. There's no way to avoid it, unfortunately. And I don't think anyone would argue that Israel is setting out purposely to cause civilian harm, whereas Hezbollah simply does. I mean, that is one of their objectives.
So
the terrorist strategy is to engage Israel in a way that forces them to fight in a way that results in civilian deaths and thus earns them the sympathy, that is Hezbollah, the sympathy of the world and the outrage.
Maybe those are the options, but you've got Brent Scowcroft, of course, who was at Bush Sr.'s right arm saying, hey, there's another way. This is the time for a U.S.-led comprehensive settlement to go beyond all this. Let's listen to Tony Blair talking about his hopes for a ceasefire this week.
I hope that not merely do we get the resolution that suspends hostilities in the next few days, but together with that, we then get an outline framework of a plan, which we can then implement in the coming time, that puts an end to the possibility of this conflict coming back.
Carol Giacomo, help us cut through the fog on this ceasefire business. There's all kinds of talk about urgently wanting it, but there doesn't seem to be any progress toward it. What would it actually take to get a ceasefire, and is there any chance of it, or are we headed into a bigger war here?
Well, I think the chance of a bigger war still looms until you get some sort of a cessation of hostilities and some sort of international force in place to try to keep the two sides apart. The problem is there are serious differences of agreement between the United States and France, in particular, which are two of the major countries that are trying to put this plan together.
But is anyone ready to pony up an international force that would get in the middle of essentially a years-long fighting war?
Well, that's a major point. The French are talking about leading such a force, but they don't want to go in until the fighting has stopped. And the United States has been urging, the United States wants an international force in there right away. And because the French idea is to have a beefed up UN force maintain the peace or try to keep monitor, you know, the hostilities,
yeah,
or cessation of hostilities until some sort of peace plan and some sort of real stop in the fighting takes hold.
We're looking at a week in the news with Carol Giacomo with Reuters News Service, diplomatic correspondent there. Syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker joins us from Columbia, South Carolina. Jack Beatty's with us. Mel Gibson in the news last week, arrested for drunk driving. He apparently unleashed just a string of anti-Semitic comments. Gibson apparently has begged forgiveness from the Jewish community. Controversy has everyone talking, from water coolers to TV talk shows. On ABC's The View, co-host Joy Behar said it wasn't just Mel, what he said, but the timing of his remarks that were so offensive.
What's going on in the Middle East right now, and for this idiot to just come out and say things like that, of course he's a drunk, and that brings the bigotry out of him.
Reverend Pat Robertson took a more forgiving tone.
I would say pray for Mel. He is a fabulous actor, a superb director, and his work on The Passion of the Christ was a landmark, and we should be greatly appreciated. And the last thing I'm going to do is throw a stone, because I'm just praying that God will restore him and bless him.
Restore him and bless him. Late night TV couldn't get enough of Mad Max. Here's Jay Leno.
Israel will stop attacking Hezbollah, but Hezbollah will not necessarily agree to stop attacking Israel. Hey, we can't even get Mel Gibson to stop attacking Israel. So it's very hard. It's very hard.
And there it is, an easy laugh line, but a tough week for these comments. Kathleen Parker, how do you think these hit? You write about popular culture and politics. How do you think this hits the American moment, the global moment, with war actually going on over there?
You know, I think we're talking about an actor with an alcohol problem who obviously has some deep issues that I think go much deeper, in fact, than his anti-Semitism. But it's also a whole lot easier to pile on Mel Gibson than to negotiate a ceasefire in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think everybody's turned on him simply because it's convenient and it's easy. It's bad timing. It's bad timing that he was drunk at whatever time of the night it was. And, you know, while his remarks were deeply offensive to all of us, you know, there comes a point where you have to say how much is enough in terms of an apology. I think the Anti-Defamation League has already said we'll forgive him. He has reached out to the Jewish community in a real way. But the truth is, what Mel Gibson needs to do is get to the root of this rage that apparently he keeps deep inside himself. And I think, personally, if you want to have my little quickie analysis, you know, I think that rage is really directed at his father, and that's what he needs to get to. His father is the one who's the public anti-Semite, and, you know, Mel Gibson can't disavow his father for some reason. And so I think turning on his father maybe it's easier to turn on the Jews, because the Jews are the problem, right? The Jews are the problem he has with this irrational father figure that he admires and cannot publicly disavow. So that's my little nickel analysis. He's got much more serious problems than what public opinion is today, and surely it will shift tomorrow when someone else does something.
We've got it. We want to hear from our listeners on that as well. Of course, Iraq was huge this week. Donald Rumsfeld finally testifying before the Senate, along with top generals. Here is Senate or General John Abizade, commander of U.S. military forces in the Middle East, acknowledging that the situation in Iraq is worsening.
The sectarian violence is probably as bad as I've seen it in Baghdad in particular, and that if not stopped, it is possible that Iraq could move towards civil war.
Carol Giacomo, big concessions, the kind of comments we have almost never heard from top generals here. Is it just so bad in Baghdad that there's no choice but to say it?
I think the facts on the ground speak for themselves, and they can't continue to put a gloss over it. I think also the American people are becoming less and less enamored of this conflict and worried that the United States isn't finding a way out of the problem. There's a new Gallup poll which said that 55% of Americans would back a U.S. pullout within a year, and just sort of as evidence of politics, but also growing Democratic dissatisfaction. Senator Clinton yesterday called for Rumsfeld's removal.
After an exchange before the committee, where I heard it last night, she asked a very pointed question, and Rumsfeld responding, "Oh my goodness," as if sort of talking to the little woman here, a U.S. senator, whatever you make of her politics. It was
you'd
an
have to look like
exchange.
The Dickens to find me ever saying this was optimistic.
no kidding.
I think that was the word Dickens. I love it.
That's pretty typical of Rumsfeld, though. I mean, he can be very charming to charming and dismissive in way. I mean, he uses all sorts of tools to try to, undermine his critics. So that was kind of vintage Rumsfeld.
Yeah, take the upper hand, the high road.
Right.
Well, you know, of course, Hillary Clinton is trying to distance herself. I mean, she's been in support of the war and also against a timetable for a pullout. So this is an opportunity for her to show the Democrats that she's tough on the war in a less direct way.
Here's Hillary Clinton speaking with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
There's a track record here. This is not 2002, 2003, 2004, 5, when you appeared before this committee and made many comments and presented, many assurances that have frankly proven to be unfulfilled. And
Senator, I don't think that's true. I have never painted a rosy picture. I've been very measured in my words. And you have a Dickens of a time trying to find instances where I've been excessively optimistic. I understand this is tough stuff.
A Dickens of a time, and now she's calling for his resignation. Jack Beatty, we're looking here at acknowledgments yesterday by these generals that Basra is militia-controlled now, that top Iraqi officials are running armed bands, that the Pentagon considers terrorist organizations financed by Iran, that about a third of the Iraqi police force cannot be trusted to fight on the right side. If we know what the right side is in this situation anymore, where do you see this headed, Jack?
Well, I think today in Baghdad there's going to be a demonstration led by Mukhtar al-Sada on the Shiite leader against the Israeli attack in Lebanon. And it's going to draw a lot of people. And the two conflicts now are interacting in a very bad way. We are seen as so close to Israel in this. A commentator at the Brookings Institute, a Lebanese newspaper man, said this week, "I've never seen the United States being so demonized or savaged by Arab commentators and Arab politicians, including moderates who are saying that are not calling for a ceasefire and letting the war go on is hurting them." But these two conflicts in Israel and in Iraq could interact in a terrible way. Imam Sistani, the Shiite leader in Iraq, has said that, this has to stop, or might well be massive demonstrations against Israel and the United States in this country we are trying to save. That would be a further complication in what you've already outlined, an insurgency, terrorism, murder squads, on and on. And, of course, what are we effectively doing now? That came out in questioning before the Senate. We're defending these death squads. I mean, that's the government. These are the people who work for the Shiite government who are doing this killing. And our job is to defend that government, presumably.
Even Tom Friedman, who, of course, supported going in here, a columnist, says staying the course is now pointless. He says it's time to start thinking about Plan B, how we might disengage with the least damage possible. Jack, Kathleen, Carol, I want to go to our callers. A lot are waiting to come in here with us. Imad is calling from Chatham, Massachusetts. Hi, Imad. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think, Imad?
I'd like to talk about Israel and Lebanon, but first, may I make a clear distinction between, and I feel this is necessary, between the Jewish people on one hand and Israeli political establishment on the other, and between criticism of Israeli political and military policy on one hand and anti-Semitism on the other.
So you don't want to get in Mel Gibson's car. We get that. What's your view?
My view is that the logic of power and destructive power, I might add, that we've been pursuing as, in the U.S., whether it's the U.S. administration or the dominant media, I think that logic of power is counterproductive and a failed policy, and I can cite many reasons for that.
What about the power of those 100 rockets an hour coming across from Hezbollah? Are you saying that's not destructive power, or that it's driven by the U.S. and Israel pushing the destruction path first?
When I say the logic of power, it is all-inclusive. Mm-hmm. We don't we really shouldn't forget, and I think it's a disservice for everybody listening to your program, to ignore the historical context and perspective of what's going on. I think we should not actively pursue an Israeli victory at all detrimental costs. I think that's a failed policy, that an Israeli victory is absolutely necessary no matter what the costs are. I think Israel's battles that result from its continued occupation and historical occupation and continued atrocities should not be the adopted fights of America. I think America's constructive goodwill is missing with the Bush administration.
Imad, we've got a big piece of that. It's a rough phone line, but we thank you for your call. Kathleen Parker, let me put it to you. There are voices now saying Israel must have a victory here. On the other hand, we're citing David Broder, Washington Post, saying we're doubling down on bad bets. You've got Brent Scowcroft talking not so much exactly about victory, but saying let's go for a big comprehensive solution here, even if it means everyone giving up something. Imad says the U.S. is pushing the logic of power, and it's not working.
Well, I think a big comprehensive solution is necessary, and I would like to see this international force come together. But I also don't see how Israel can afford. I don't know if we really want to talk about it in terms of winning and losing. I mean, I think they're trying to clear a protective barrier so they can prevent future rockets coming in, and I think that's a perfectly legitimate goal.
But they're talking about it in winning and losing terms, that Hezbollah, Carol Giacomo, Hezbollah must be seen to suffer a defeat here after all this.
Well, that's what the Israelis are saying for sure. A Hezbollah victory may be just emerging and still intact at the end of the day, being able to say we still have a Hezbollah, even if their capabilities have been degraded. I just want to make a couple of points respond to the caller. Israel has withdrawn from some of the territory. It is an occupying power, but it has withdrawn from Gaza. It did withdraw from Lebanon. And, from the Israeli point of view, this goodwill or these tactical moves have not necessarily brought the kind of peace that Israel was hoping. The other point I wanted to make is with the Americans and the call for a comprehensive peace, there are many analysts who believe that the Bush administration has made an error because it's squandered the long-term American role as an honest broker in
disengaged.
The
it's not talking with half the players out there now.
Right. It doesn't talk. Well, it doesn't really talk with the Syrians, although we do have a chargé there, and it does not talk directly to Iran, for one thing. So making a Middle East comprehensive peace is really difficult to do without two of the most important actors.
Of course, we've got Brzezinski now talking about what all we're getting out of what he calls a radical policy shift is greater regional instability and Islamist terrorism with global economic and political ripples. Gene's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to say about Mel Gibson that, first of all, some people are saying, well, he was drunk as though that were an excuse. There's an old saying, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth, and I believe that people say when they're drunk what either personal inhibition or social pressure keeps them from saying when they're sober.
Jackie Mason was saying on TV last night, he was drunk, forget about it.
Well, I don't believe that. I should mention that I've worked as a drug and alcohol counselor, and my experience is that, as I said, it lowers inhibition. The second thing about Mel Gibson is that we have a lot of evidence of his being an anti-Semite, and one thing, people have mentioned that he belongs to this splinter group that separated itself from mainstream Roman Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
What I have not seen mentioned very often is that what it specifically and explicitly separated itself over was the document of Vatican II that said the Jews were no longer to be blamed for the death of Christ.
Right.
And the Jews could be saved.
A parting way of ways right there. Jack Beatty, I know this is a story you're not so interested in. Do you think it's just a one-off, just one actor on a tear, or is there any larger significance at this moment?
Well, if you look up on the ADL website, they document something like 1,400 anti-Semitic incidents last year. These are serious matters, swastikas, people being harassed. And just a week ago, The Times ran a story about Georgetown, Delaware, which is a kind of a vacation spot or near one for the Washington elite. Well, it turns out that a Jewish family there has had to leave the town, the county, because they protested against the use of prayer in the schools, which is rampant, and which in the graduation ceremony included a statement by a reverend that Jesus is the only way to the truth. You either have Jesus or you're damned. This is in a public school. This is going on right now. So, you know, quite apart from Mel Gibson, there is intolerance, even built around things we thought were long settled, like school prayer, all over the country. And ominously enough, as the Southern Poverty Law Center pointed out, something approaching 300 Aryan Nation skinheads have joined the U.S. military recently, and the neo-Nazi websites are saying, join up. And Aryan Nation swastikas and insignia are seen now in Baghdad. That is to say, we are down to the dregs. We are recruiting some people from these extremist anti-Semitic Nazi groups joining our military. So America has a lot to look in the mirror about religious the tolerance of religious minorities, quite apart from Mel Gibson.
So hold on to your hats. Kathleen Parker, do you see America... I mean, there's a poll out that was taken last weekend, sort of right through before and after the Khanna attacks, that showed still 59% of Americans backing Israel in this dispute. Do you see any weakening in that?
You know, I think Americans see Israel as our ally in the Middle East, and that I think there's this idea that if Israel loses, we lose. And so I think that's part of it. But I wanted to just to get back to what Jack was saying for a minute and about Mel. You know, I do think, I mean, he does belong to this fringe organization that left the Roman Catholic Church after Vatican II, and that it's true that there is an anti-Semitic dimension to that. And so what would be most helpful for Mel Gibson, if he does come to terms with those demons that he carries around inside him, he could do a great thing here, which is to come out and say, you know, I have been very confused about this anti-Semitic element of my church. If he can do it, I mean, it will bring him to his knees to do it. That's why I'm saying this goes so much deeper and requires some analysis.
We're looking at a week in the news, from Lebanon to the heat wave to Fidel Castro and the minimum wage. Kathleen Parker, syndicated columnist, is with us. Diplomatic correspondent for Reuters News Service Carol Giacomo is here, and our own Jack Beatty. You know, Britain and California formed a transatlantic, and more than that, partnership in this past week to look at global warming. Tony Blair was in California. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said it's now necessary for states to take up the issue on their own.
We see that there is not great leadership from the federal government when it comes to protecting the environment. So this is why we as a state move forward with it, because we want to show leadership.
Carol Giacomo, what's Tony Blair doing going to California to talk with a governor about global warming in this hot week?
Well, you know, Tony Blair has suffered in part because he's so closely aligned with Bush. And I think he has some real priorities in terms of protecting the environment. And California is a big state, and Schwarzenegger is a welcome partner in this pursuit. It also puts him, you know, sort of separates him somewhat from Bush, because a lot of people, a lot of critics, don't like where he stands on global warming.
Jack Beatty, bring us home to Congress. Minimum wage was up for a bump this week, but then so was a cut in the estate tax on the agenda there. The Senate turned all that down. Republicans had packaged it together, an interesting sort of a couple bucks for the poor and, I don't know, billions for the rich. What do you make of the fate of that bill?
Yeah, all but three Republicans voted for it, and all but four Democrats voted against it. Well, that was an interesting and, I think, emblematic package. We did a series recently on inequality in America, and there it was, that they were packaging a pay raise for 6 million Americans, and the price of that was elimination on taxes on the 6,000 Americans a year who died, who would be eligible to pay the estate tax under current law. You know, the estate tax is a juggernaut. The abolition of it is a juggernaut of inequality. It has been arranged and driven by 18 super-rich families, including heirs to the Mars fortune, the Waltons from Walmart, and so on. And these folks, since 1998 have spent $490 million on congressional campaign contributions, on lobbying, on propaganda to get what would amount to $71 billion in tax cuts. And they are not going to give up. Because they have limitless funds, and there may be another vote for this on this in September. And you know, the claims made about it are so patently false. You know, the family farm is at risk. The American Farm Bureau in 2001, when the limit was $600,000, much lower than today, could find no case of a family farm being seized because it couldn't pay the estate tax. The other claim, you know, it's double taxation. Mr. Bush says that's wrong. In fact, studies show that 70% of the assets in these wealthy estates has never been taxed. It's capital gains. So on and on these lies go, and yet this is a popular thing. As we pointed out in our inequality series, frightening percentages of Americans earning less than $50,000 think it's a good idea to get rid of the estate tax. So it's a very, you know, I think we all should be grateful it didn't pass. Anybody who cares about fiscal sanity has to feel that way, and also anyone who cares about justice. But isn't it a shame that the poorest people and the hardest working people in the country couldn't get a pay raise?
Kathleen Parker, how do you see Henry Paulson, super rich himself, coming in from Goldman Sachs to be the new Secretary of Treasury, himself recently said, you know, maybe we do have a problem with inequality, with the size of the gap in this country.
Oh,
do you see
think?
This moving politically?
I wish I had this problem. I should really pass on this because this is not one of the topics I've covered closely or followed closely. But I've always wondered why we couldn't at least, you know, find, is there a compromise position here? Could we not set the bar at, say, I don't know, 20 million or something? But these mega rich people who are worried about you know, what's going to happen to as Jack says, the family farm is kind of ludicrous. And, you know, I'm all in favor of raising the minimum wage myself. But, you know, like I said, this is not my topic. So let me pass to somebody who's more knowledgeable.
Carol?
I think this issue is one of the issues that contributes to a very confused image sometimes of America overseas, where it's seen by you know, millions of people as a land of opportunity. On the other hand, there is this huge disparity between rich and poor.
Let's look at that right across the water between South Florida and Cuba, if we can. We've talked about Fidel Castro's situation this week, but what about the politics of this? Carol Giacomo, in Washington, how do you see this playing out? The Cuban exiles in Florida have been very potent in electoral terms. Is that going to drive Bush administration policy as Cuba apparently enters some kind of transition phase?
Well, it certainly looks as if it is under some sort of transition. And Bush yesterday, hearkening to politics, but also to his own stated perceptions, called for democratic change in Cuba and promised that the United States would help to encourage this, which is a somewhat risky. I mean, this is a very uncertain time in Cuba, and this is, to some analysts' view, a rather risky move by Bush, because I just can't help but think back to after the Gulf War, when Bush's father was president, and he made some public statements encouraging the Shiites in Iraq to rise up and overthrow Saddam. And, you know, the Shiites, a lot of them tried to do that, and they were just brutally crushed by Saddam. And you sort of worry, you know, what might happen if Cubans followed suit.
Not much said explicitly, but you can read the lines between the lines this week. Here's some tape from State Department spokesman Sean McCormick saying Cuba wants to be free.
We believe that the Cuban people aspire and thirst for democracy, and that given the choice, that they would choose a democratic government, and that they would choose the option of being able to choose their own leaders.
Jim's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Jim. What do you see in the world this week?
Well, I just wanted to mention about what you were talking about, the estate tax, and I'm just hopeful that some of the rich people out there might look at Warren Buffett as an example of maybe what the right thing is to do. That was basically my comment.
That is, give billions, in his case, away through Bill Gates. We've got it. Jack Beatty, you've been following the anniversary of a labor strike, a failed labor strike this week, Petco, 25 years ago. Remind us of that?
Yes, Ronald Reagan discharged the 12,500 air traffic controllers who had against the law. I mean, there was no, they were not allowed to by law, gone out on strike. Quite apart from the rights or wrongs of that decision, the consequences of it are clear. It's a milestone in the history of labor and in the history of American inequality. The law had long allowed replacement workers. That had been clear since its Supreme Court decision from the 30s. But it was rarely done. There was a kind of public pressure against it. I mean, it was seemed to be very unfair. Someone goes out on strike, and then the employer says, "Oh, okay, we're just going to fire you and hire new people." It wasn't done. Well, it is done today, and it's done in people don't even sign on to unions for fear that if they quit, they'll lose their jobs, and they're absolutely right. And you know, the figures dramatize it. They show a sharp decline from 235 strikes involving a total of 1 million workers in 1979 to a record low of just 17 strikes involving just 73,000 workers in 1999. Between 47 and 80, the U.S. averaged about 300 strikes a year. Since 1981, 47. Labor has lost, and working people have lost, one of the most powerful weapons they had to get a better life, the threat to withhold their labor and to put the employer under pressure. That has been undercut. And ironically, of course, Ronald Reagan is the only labor leader ever to have been elected president of the United States.
There's a change in the environment, I'd say. Jim is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Yes, I just had a comment. The Republican Party wants to make felons out of illegal immigrants from Mexico predominantly, but then the Cubans are allowed to come here without any waiting. They say, well, everybody else should go back and get in line. The Cubans don't have to. They're the darlings of the Republican Party for whatever reason. They don't have to wait in line. They're waving Cuban flags the other night. Nobody questioned their allegiance to the United States as they did the other immigrants when they were waving Mexican flags.
Do you think the U.S., Washington, is going to wade into Cuba's transition or watch from across the water, Jim?
I think they're just going to try to do anything they can to undermine the government down there. I think it's ridiculous. I think if we had a positive relationship with Cuba, the chances of changing their situation would be substantially greater than just isolating them. It makes no sense. It makes no sense to common people when they look at that situation.
Jim, thanks very much for your call. Let me get another from Salem, Massachusetts. Rick is on the line. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment with regards to the estate tax and thinking that, you know, the minimum wage may have had a chance to pass if these pieces of legislation were not bundled together.
Even a lot of Republicans were saying they need to pass it because they've got some political fear about it still sitting there at 5 whatever an hour, 5:15.
Yeah, I know. I think that we would have a much more effective legislation form of government if they just wouldn't bundle these pieces of legislation together. Look at each one separately. Look at each one for its own merits on its own ground.
Of course, that wasn't the point. Kathleen Parker, Bill Frist played a role in bundling those together. He's been seen as a potential presidential candidate, but that didn't work out. A lot of things haven't worked out for Bill Frist lately. Do you still see
I don't think Bill Frist is a player. You know, all we have to do is wait for the replay of the film with him diagnosing Terri Schiavo by video, and I think that'll be the end of it. I don't think he's a serious player at all. And or alternatively, he just has to get up and speak a couple of times publicly, and you know, and everyone will be asleep, and that'll be that. I wanted to say something real quick about Cuba because
yes.
I was down there a few years ago, and I grew up in Florida with the Cubans, and so have had this sort of lifelong relationship with the Cuban people who have come here, by the way, legally. But I do agree that the embargo has been a bad and outdated idea. It obviously hasn't worked, and it has in fact given Castro an excuse to sort of something to blame for all the problems down there. And there are lots and lots of problems. People live in great poverty. And so it would have been, I think, much better had we lifted the embargo, allowed free travel between the U.S. and Cuba, because the truth is, at least my experience there, is the Cuban people love the American people and very much would like to interact. They are interacting right now with Europeans and Canadians and have great exposure to Western, you know, other Westerners, and they're enjoying the an underground dollar economy. So it would have been, I think, much more sensible to let them, through exposure to Americans, I think the democratic government that is going to emerge eventually would have been helped along by that exposure.
Maybe a change in the climate that will allow a whole new framework for that relationship. That would be refreshing. Let me take a call from Washington, D.C. Cam is on the line. Hi, Cam. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm Lebanese, so, of course, at the top of my news is what's going on in Lebanon and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And just like one of your panelists just said about the Cubans, the Lebanese do love the Americans, and they want to interact with the Americans. I've been in America for 18 years, and I love living here. I do taxes, I work for the government. I love the Americans, but I don't necessarily like the American government.
Mm-hmm.
However, what's going on in the Middle East, we can argue till we're blue in the face of who's responsible and who started what, because it's not just about Hezbollah abducting two soldiers. Israel has continuously broken Lebanon's sovereignty over the years and so on and so forth. But what I would like to suggest as a way out of this, of course, maybe it's not an immediate way out, but eventually, that if you can, what Israel gets in aid from the U.S. to what Lebanon gets in aid from the U.S., it is almost inconsequential.
So what's the answer?
So the Hezbollah came out because there is abject poverty in Lebanon and because the Shia have been historically out of poverty.
Yeah, Cam, your line's breaking up, but we thought Lebanon was on a better path. It's unbelievably. Just weeks ago, Syria pushed out a lot of hopes there, the Bush administration putting it forward as a model for their dreams of democratic revitalization in the Middle East. Carol Giacomo, what about the big project, radical, Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski calls it. Is it in tatters? Is anybody standing up and saying they've still got a chance to transform this region for the better? I mean, it just looks like a sea of troubles and maybe getting worse lately.
Well, the Bush administration still talks about opportunities. They are saying, Secretary Rice has said and the president has said, that they see this conflict in Lebanon as being an opportunity to help shape the Middle East further. But there are an awful lot of people who feel the way you do, which is, you know, you look around and you see nothing but conflict, and it doesn't seem to be getting better. One of the things we really haven't spoken about very much is sort of the elephant in the room, which is Iran, and the feeling that Lebanon is really a proxy war for Iran because it's the biggest backer of Hezbollah.
And of course, Iran saying it's not going to respond to the UN demand that it pony up on the nuclear front.
Right, and its president has repeatedly, in fact, I think he repeated it again yesterday, called for the destruction of Israel. So it's it poses or appears to pose a threat.
And Kathleen Parker, how do you see it at this sort of top level, this big project of the Bush administration, their number one chip they've kind of put down overall in their 6 years in office now, working or working toward disaster?
Well, golly gee, as Rumsfeld would say, we'd have to work pretty hard to be optimistic at this point. Things are not obviously going well anywhere, and it does have this sort of apocalyptic feel to it. So, you know, it's if you go and look at some of the blogs over in the Middle East, you get a little bit of a glimmer of hope over there.
In what corner?
Well, I was looking at one this morning. Iraq the Model has some commentary up that, you know, what's happening in Beirut and what's happening in Baghdad are both, you know, we've both got terrorist activity and conflict where democracies are trying to succeed. And they want us out because they think, well, we're going to make things worse by staying. And then in one breath, the next breath, they say, please don't leave us because it's going to blow up. So, you know, I have no solution, but it doesn't seem to be going well, and I think that the elections in November are going to be very interesting.
It's hard to find that democratic blossom in the rubble right now. Kathleen Parker, syndicated columnist, with us today from Columbia, South Carolina. Kathleen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
And Carol Giacomo, diplomatic correspondent for Reuters. Carol, thanks for being here.
You're very welcome.
Jack, good to have you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.